all our Voice of America listeners. This is VOA's Sonny Young in Washington. Thanks for tuning in this evening. Welcome to the sunny side of sports.
Friends, we can all listen to the sunny side of sports.
Yes, my friend.
The sunny side of sports.
Sunny side of sports.
The sunny side of sports show.
Great show, bro. This is sunny side of sports.
Sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
Stand up. Stand up. Stand up. Stand up.
Let's begin here in Washington. That's where the new Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture officially opened over the weekend. The late, great former world heavyweight boxing champion Muhammad Ali is fondly remembered at the museum. Among the sports items on display are one of Ali's training robes, as well as some of his headgear and boxing gloves. Former world heavyweight boxing champion Larry Holmes is one of only five men to beat Muhammad Ali during his professional career. In this encore Sunny Side of Sports presentation, let's listen in again as the Voice of America's Straight Talk Africa host, Shaka Sali, asks Holmes for his reaction after finding out Ali died on June 3rd at age 74.
Well, I kind of like inspect it because, you know, a few months ago I was down there in Louisville with him, and he didn't look too good. And I said to my wife, I don't know about that. I said, I don't think he got too much longer. I said, he don't look good because he didn't talk. He didn't just sit there, just stood. And, you know, I was, like, worried, you know, and I didn't want to go back and see him again. But I went back and seen him again. He was still the same, doing the same thing, so. But I kind of expected, but one of the things about it hurt me. It hurt me because not only he was a friend of mine, but I think he was one of the greatest fighters ever lived in this world.
You happen to be one of the elite five boxers that, in fact, defeated at one time Muhammad Ali. But yet again, you happen perhaps to be a very unique individual, given that you were his former sparring partner, a friend, and, of course, eventually a world heavyweight champion. What was it like to fight Muhammad Ali?
It was a good pleasure fighting Muhammad because, you know, he was my friend and he was my boss. And then I had to fight him, you know, but then it was the money thing, you know. If I beat him, I'd be the old man. If I lost, I never had anything. So, you know, my thing was not to take it hard on him because, you know, I knew how he would fight. And I knew that I could beat him, so I don't want to hurt Muhammad Ali because he is my friend. And so when we fought, you know, I told him, don't get hurt. Just don't go crazy. I did. I said, I don't want to hurt nobody. I don't want you to be hurt. And, you know, he told me, shut up and fight, you know. And I did what I had to do without hurting him, I think. I don't think I hurt him. And, you know, we remained friends because right after the fight, I went back to his dressing room and I told him, I gave him a hug and told him I love him. And he said, if you love me, why you beat me up like that, man? So, you know, he was a great man. And he wasn't angry with me or nothing like that because it was about the money. He got $10 million. And, you know, back then, that was a lot of money, you know? So he was happy. And we remained friends even after the fight.
Any particular reason, Rally, why you cried after the bout? You don't seem really to have enjoyed the fight.
I don't enjoy the fight. He was my friend. He was my boss. You know what I mean? You know, he was a guy that helped teach me how to fight. I mean, when I first went with him in 1971, I was just an amateur. I was learning how to fight. And he gave me the opportunity to come to his camp and work out with him and learn from him. He gave me that opportunity. When I worked out with Muhammad Ali for the very first time, we went to Reading, Pennsylvania. He gave me gloves and shoes, everything to box with, and he gave me the opportunity to box. And when he boxed with me, of course, he gave me the black eye, right? He gave me the black eye, and I loved it. And I said, it's okay. he wanted to put ice on my eye, and I won't let him put ice because why? I said, because I'm showing this off Muhammad Ali hit me in my eye. I said, God, this is nice. I can show it off. And, you know, he told me I was crazy, put the ice, but I never put ice. And then when I got home, I bragged about Muhammad Ali boxing me and giving me a black eye. It was a brag. Yeah, I bragged about it.
Now, knowing him the way you did, and of course you have to be one of the few very unique individuals that do that, do you sincerely feel, do you sincerely think that it was necessary for Muhammad Ali to fight the last two fights? I'm talking about yours and the one of Trevor Babik in the Bahamas.
Yeah, well, Trevor Babik, he didn't need to fight, but what it was about was the money. It was about the money with Ali. He started fighting for money after he couldn't beat me. He just said, I'll take a fight with money. And I didn't like that fight. I didn't think he should have took it. But again, you can't tell people what to do because, you know, the man, when I do tell him that he's a champ, I said, shut up. He can do what he want to do, so I don't say anything. Well, if he was the champ, in my opinion, he was always going to be the champ. So, you know, the Babik fight, the Trevor Babik fight, Trevor Babik didn't fight the Ali that I fought. If he did, he would have got beat.
You, again, happen to be one of the few people that interacted with him in a very special manner. What is it that during that experience, really, that you learned? What did you learn from him, and what did that interaction mean to you?
Hey, listen, I got the best jab in boxing. I had the best jab in boxing because of Muhammad Ali, because I tried to keep up with him. And when he threw the jab, I wanted to throw the jab. I wanted to beat him to the jab because everybody knew how Ali was. Everybody knew that he was a good jabber. He always jabbed right-hand combination. And I wanted to be like that, so I worked on that to beat him to the jab. And that's why I lasted so long in boxing, because I had a good jab. Everybody had to worry about the Larry Holmes jab. And then when they worried about the Larry Holmes jab, then they had to worry about the right. And so they couldn't do both. And I was able to win the fight.
What was it like being with him in Zaire back in 1974? I'm talking about the Rambo in the jungle.
In the jungle. I was there with him. I was there with Muhammad Ali, with the Rambo in the jungle, in Zaire. And he trained good. I mean, you know, people love him. Ali Boumaye. Ali Boumaye.
Ali killed him.
Yeah. And, you know, there's all a lot of people that didn't speak good English, but they know how to say Ali Boumaye. We didn't know how to speak African, so we said Ali Boumaye. You know, we said the same thing, Ali Boumaye, Ali Boumaye. And it was neat. And people, everywhere you go, people love you. You know, they run after, they take little kids running behind the car, Ali, Ali, Ali. I mean, you know, it was mind-boggling. And you know what Ali said? He said, boy, he said, you're home. This is home, man. This is what our people look like. That's what we look like. And you know, he was very proud to be in Zaire. And I was just as proud as he was because I was with the greatest fighter of all time.
Any particular reason why the people preferred Ali to the champion himself, George Foreman?
George Foreman, though, it was okay boxing. But, you know, But George Foreman, they didn't like George Foreman. I mean, you know, because Ali, they loved Ali, they didn't like George Foreman. Because George Foreman wasn't no Muhammad Ali. Everywhere Ali go, people go with him. But George, they didn't do that with George. That's okay, because I didn't like George either.
I see. Have you been to Africa, Lale, since 1974?
I did not go to Zaire, but I've been to different parts of Africa already. Yeah, I've been to different parts.
What is it like to be a world heavyweight champion of the world? And you were for many years.
Well, it was an honor to be the heavyweight champion of the world. It's an honor to represent black fighters that to be able to do something. It was great to honor white fighters if they work hard enough, they can be something, you know. It means something when anybody that works hard as I work can be anything that they want to be. You know, whether you're black, whether white, or orange, or green color, I don't care. If you work at something, you can always be that. Ali was living proof that if you work at it, you can be it. And he was one example. He moralized boxing, and he would go down as one of the greatest fighters of all time. And I'm just glad to say that I was one of the guys who helped him become one of the great fighters of all time.
That's former world heavyweight boxing champion Larry Holmes. And Larry was talking with the VOA's Straight Talk Africa host, Shaka Solly, from the eastern U.S. state of Pennsylvania.
Voice of America!
If you were to talk to us from the deepest, better part of the bottom of your heart. Hello, I am Shaka Solly, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Solly saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.
Anti-hate groups such as Kick It Out expressed surprise at FIFA's announcement this week that they would eliminate their anti-racism task force. The international governing body of football says the task force had completed their mission. Paul Mortimer is Kick It Out's professional players engagement manager. In an interview with reporter Ricky Shryock, he says there's still racism in football, especially against players of African descent in Europe.
In listening to what they say, it's almost like their job has been done, which is something they've said. And for us, who recognise that there's still a lot of work to be done around racism within in Europe, it's somewhat perplexing.
Can you give me examples of why this task force should still be around, incidents of racism?
We've had issues in certain aspects, in certain parts of Europe, like Russia, where black players have been openly racially abused. And not enough has really been done about it. Those issues have been happening for, you know, the last couple of years, to be honest. You know, there have been, you know, parts of Italy and places where there have been issues around discriminatory racist behaviour. There's been aspects of anti-Semitism. Those are this type of behaviour that's unacceptable, that really, for us, highlights there is still a lot of work to be done. You know, we cannot give ourselves a pat on the back in Europe or even around the world, because there is so much more work that needs to be done to combat this kind of behavior.
Now, last year, FIFA introduced an anti-discrimination monitoring system. Is that still in place, and how does that work?
Well, from what I gather, it was to monitor issues and situations that may happen at games, which is a difficult thing to do because there are so many games played in Europe. Monitoring every single one at the same time is a very difficult thing to do. But from what I gather, that's what it was about. It was about monitoring games, especially, I suppose, flashpoint games, you know, where there could be situations that could arise. It's often those games that situations don't arise. You know, there's lots of games played throughout Europe during the year that are not monitored, where issues arise. And it's not the fact that the issues are arising, because that's going to happen. It's what we do. It's what we put into place to highlight and expose the behaviour, and then to educate people to understand the impact that their behaviour can have on those affected by it.
What would your organisation like to see happen in the long run? Because as your organisation said, there is still racism that occurs at these events sometimes.
Well, our role and the role of other anti-discrimination and racist organisations around Europe and around the world is to highlight to FIFA that these situations are still happening, that they are still occurring, and to challenge FIFA in what they're going to do about it. You know, it's clear, you know, all organisations are actively campaigning against racism and discrimination. And it's disappointing and disheartening to hear that kind of news. But it's up to us in football to lead the way in projecting, I suppose you could call, an inclusive nature for the world. I mean, there's no doubt football has the power to unite people from all different backgrounds. And it is important to recognise that there is good work being done to promote equality across football, but also to understand and to acknowledge and to accept that there is a lot more work to be done.
That's Paul Mortimer, the professional players engagement manager for Kick It Out, an organisation that works within the football, educational and community sectors to challenge discrimination. And he was talking with reporter Ricky Shryock. The head coach of CSKA Moscow Football Club, Leonid Slutsky, says Tottenham fans have nothing to fear in Russia, despite the violence between English and Russian supporters at the European Championship. CSKA is hosting Tottenham later Tuesday evening in a Group E UEFA Champions League match. About 300 Tottenham fans are expected to attend this evening's game. It's the first visit to Russia by an English club since the clashes in Marseille, France in June. Check out the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. The address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny. Once again, that address, facebook.com/VOA Sunny. You'll see photos and videos, and you can post your comments. So check out the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page.
Voice of America.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Listen to VOA's program lineup, live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcast. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
During Monday's Sunny Side of Sports, VOA's Andrew Palcheski talked about the late golf great Arnold Palmer and his legacy, which includes a cool beverage that carries his name, the Arnold Palmer drink, a combination of iced tea and lemonade, had its origins in the 1960s, according to Palmer. He said he got the idea when his late wife, Winnie, made iced tea, and then inspiration struck him. Arnold Palmer was also a very successful businessman. So it shouldn't be too surprising to our VOA listeners that since 2001, Arnold Palmer Enterprises and the Arizona Beverage Company have been selling the drink in cans featuring his name and face. And speaking of Andrew Palcheski, he joins us now from VOA's New York Bureau. Sporty greetings, Andrew.
Sporty greetings, Sonny. Good to be with you from up here in New York.
Welcome back, Andrew. First off, how about a few thoughts on that epic U.S. presidential debate?
Epic is one word for it, for sure. It was very exciting to be there. It was an electric atmosphere on campus at Hofstra University and in the press center. And actually, there is a sporting connection to the debate last night because two of the surrogates that I saw there, two of the big names there on behalf of Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, are connected to the sports world. So first, you had legendary college basketball coach Bobby Knight. He's a Trump supporter. I saw him actually getting off of a golf cart. They were shuttling him over to the press center so he could talk to reporters, and he was stopping to take pictures with everybody. And then after the debate, I saw Mark Cuban, who is the billionaire owner of the Dallas Mavericks basketball team. He was there to support Hillary Clinton, and he was actually sitting in the audience for the debate, and he was talking to the press. So even in the sports world, there's some political action as we all approach the election in about, maybe, what is it, 7 weeks from today or 6 weeks from yesterday, I guess it was.
Andrew, I know on a previous show you mentioned how another Trump supporter is the veteran boxing promoter Don King. Any sign of Don King there at Hofstra University?
Don King was there, although I didn't see him. He doesn't have the same hair that he once had, so it's a little harder to pick him out of the crowd. But no, Don King actually was there as well, so he's another sporting connection here, is there on behalf of Donald Trump. But no, lots of athletes and owners making their voices heard this election season for sure.
Well, Andrew, what about the sports world? What is trending out there in terms of social media?
Well, everyone's continuing to talk about the untimely death of Jose Fernandez, the Miami Marlins pitcher, and died in that boating accident over the weekend. And Miami Marlins had their first game since his death Monday night, where they played my New York Mets. And the Miami Marlins won, and I'm talking to people here in New York, just about everyone I talked to said, you know what, we may be Mets fans, but they really should have won this one, and we're glad that the Marlins did win this one. So really, this transcends any kind of sports allegiances. But the debate last night was trending all through the night. I think it was the top 10 Twitter trending topics in the U.S. for about the whole night, except for one name that was trending, and that was Dee Gordon. Now, Dee Gordon is the leadoff hitter for the Miami Marlins. And he made news first because he went up wearing Jose Fernandez's batting helmet and bat from the right side. He took the first pitch of the game from the right side. Now, he bats lefty, D. Gordon, but he did this first pitch, took it from the right side of the home plate to honor Jose Fernandez, honor his teammate. So that made news right there. And then just two pitches later, he made news again, hitting a home run. It is his first home run of the season. And you can see the tears streaming down his face as he rounds the bases. And as soon as he crosses home plate, he just points up to the sky. So that was a really stirring moment that got people talking on social media. The video of that home run repeatedly viewed. And in fact, D. Gordon was mentioned over 350,000 times on Twitter as a result of that home run. So a really, really touching moment, one of many that we saw in that game that people talked about on social media. The other one was at the start of the game, everyone was wearing number 16 and had Fernandez on the back of their jersey. They were all wearing that in tribute to Jose Fernandez. The Marlins management has said that they might retire that number, and they said certainly no one's going to be wearing it anytime soon, and that's something that has really resonated with fans on social media. They're saying they should retire that number, no one should use it. And then at the end of the game after the Marlins won, they all went to the pitcher's mound and left their hats on the pitcher's mound as a sign of tribute to him. So really something that the people are talking about and something that transcends the sports world. People, even if they're not sports fans, are talking about this, saying what a great moment it was to honor this player who passed away far too soon.
The late Miami Marlins pitcher Jose Fernandez, certainly a trending topic this week. I encourage our Voice of America listeners to follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOASunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOASunnySports. If you go to my Facebook page today, you'll see a photo of me with Shaka Sali, our Straight Talk Africa host. We heard from Shaka earlier in the program interviewing Larry Holmes. Andrew, what else is trending in the sports world?
Well, we have some big retirement news out of the National Basketball Association. Paul Pierce has announced that he is retiring after this season. The Truth, as he is known, of course, Kansas player, so that's why I know Paul Pierce, the Kansas Jayhawks, which I love. But there have been a lot of retirements in the past year or so that have really struck National Basketball Association fans. In addition to Paul Pierce this week announcing his retirement after the season, we're getting word that Chris Bosh is out for the season and that he may be done in Miami. He might not be returning to that team. Fans are really struck by this. And even though it's, you know, we're talking about baseball and American football and all these sports, basketball, all these basketball stories are resonating with a lot of those fans. And there was one tweet I saw that I thought was very interesting. Somebody tweeted out and said, between Kobe Bryant, Tim Duncan, Kevin Garnett, Paul Pierce, he says, the NBA of my childhood, the NBA that I grew up with, is slowly disappearing. So that's really, you know, something to think about, is how much of an impact these players have, not just on the court with what they do, but in influencing people's lives and fans around the world.
And those players you mentioned, Andrew, Kevin Garnett, Tim Duncan, Paul Pierce, and their impact, I certainly think we're going to see them in the Basketball Hall of Fame down the road. I think they have to wait 5 years before they're eligible for induction, but certainly great careers by all of them.
Oh, absolutely. And actually, just another one breaking today is former All-Star Mo Williams says that he's also retiring. So people wondering, why is this spate of retirements happening so soon? Is something going on? But no, I think we'll be hearing those names for years to come. I don't think with these retirements, we're not going to hear from them again. I think certainly they're going to be major forces in the game, even off the court.
Andrew Palcheski, the Voice of America's social media reporter. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you very much, Sonny.
And that wraps up the September 27th edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. Thanks to Voice of America producer Bill Werkinger. Thanks also to VOA engineer John Dryden. And thank you for tuning in. I'm VOA's Sonny Young in Washington, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. We'll be right back.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
7 years ago, at the G8 summit in L'Aquila, Italy, President Barack Obama pledged the United States to a $3.5 billion investment in agriculture-led economic growth to combat hunger. This commitment helped garner more than $16 billion from other donors to support this new approach to advance agricultural development and reduce hunger around the world. President Obama's pledge gave rise to the Feed the Future initiative, a global program to fight hunger and poverty. In a recently issued report entitled A Food Secure 2030, Feed the Future notes that L'Aquila marked a turning point in the fight against global hunger and poverty because it was able to garner the political will and resources necessary for such a transnational food security and anti-poverty program to succeed. And succeed it did. Working with both government and private partners all over the world, Feed the Future has helped countries raise their agricultural output and improve nutrition for those in need. So, for example, last year alone, 9 million farmers and producers who worked with Feed the Future markedly improved their yields and efficiency, collectively boosting their incomes by more than $800 million. In the report, Feed the Future calls for governments of developing countries to lead the fight against hunger and poverty by mobilizing the resources, partnerships, and policies that are required for success. For donors to renew and increase their monetary commitments, for the private sector to raise their engagement and investment levels, and for civil society to pressure and support these actors to translate commitments into action. If this can be achieved, the world will be a different place by the year 2030. It will be a world free from hunger, malnutrition, and poverty, where thriving local economies generate increased income for all people, where people consume balanced and nutritious diets, and children grow up healthy and reach their full potential, and where resilience helps to reduce vulnerability. For the first time ever, humanity is within reach of the elimination of hunger, undernutrition, and extreme poverty. To achieve this milestone, the United States calls on the global community to unite around our shared vision by the year 2030.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Hello, I'm Lenore Moudou. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
Hello, Africa. This is James Barty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, a conversation with Arthur Opio Oloya about his book, Black Hawks Rising, the story of AMISOM's successful war against Somali insurgency. That's next, right here on Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.